Hey, kids.
You're listening to the internet's wettest podcast about video games, consoles,
and pancakes.
The SML Podcast.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I'm your host, Joe. Joining as usual on a party cast, we've got Tim, we've got Chris, we've got Purnell, and we've got Brooke. How is everybody doing?
Pretty good. Purnell, did you buy that copy of Transformers Beast Wars Transmetals for $1,249 at that con?
I came so close, but I found a better purchase that was worth a little. It was like $1,500, so I had to make the better judgment. You know, I'd buy Glover for $1,500 instead.
Hell yeah! I love Nintendo 64 games achieving the price tag of a decent used car.
That is pretty ridiculous that an N64 game runs that much.
You didn't even mention the most expensive one that was there.
I know, because that's a good game.
It's a great game, but I still ain't paying that much for it. Holy shit.
Was it too many games?
Yeah, it was too many games. And they had a shrink copy of Goemon's Great Adventure on the N64, and it had 3499 on it. I walked into the guy, he's like, excuse me, are you missing a decimal point on that price tag? He's like, no. I'm like, in what universe is that game worth $3,499? And he goes, well, you know, the game, when it's shrink-wrapped and everything, the price pretty much doubles. I'm like, so what you're trying to tell me is that a non-shrink-wrapped open copy is still worth over a K? Just my ass. I love the game. Ain't a game out there worth that much money, especially a game that actually got a print.
Like, now, don't you have a bunch of games worth, like, that much?
I do, but just because I own them doesn't mean I believe they're worth that much. If someone wants to walk up to me and offer me a thing, like, what was it, like, Magic Knight Rare, that I actually tried to sell that, I guess last year, or early this year, but I did it under the stipulation that it has to go for over 1,000, because I didn't want to let the game go, but at the same time, people were like, you should just let it, why would you keep it for, if a game's worth a grand? I'm like, because it's not worth a grand. I don't know who these people are, but they're not going to buy my copy. So, and he was like, you know what, screw it. I'm putting it on eBay, I'm making a minimum of $1,000, if I can sell it, I'm going to sell it. And this is going to be like splitting hairs, I'm not going to lie, but someone did come at me, he's like, I'll give you $900. Like, no, I want $1,000.
I would have taken the 9.
Well, the thing is, like, I didn't really have an interest in letting it go. It was specifically on the premise that I can sell it for the price people claim it's worth, right? So if it doesn't move for that price, then I don't prove anything, and I didn't want the money.
That's
so
fair.
Now, don't get me wrong, when student loans kick back in, I might move it.
I don't have any student loans. So I'm going to do everything I can to make my, like, valuable games less valuable. Like, I'm gonna be opening up sealed games and stuff.
I've done that. Do.
I don't have student loans, but I've sold a lot of valuable games. So maybe a corollary there.
The sad part too is that every once in a while I find myself thinking, what would be kind of cool is if I did the thing where you take a game that's worth a lot of money, board or video, and just leave it at Goodwill, and like maybe someone who's really underprivileged could want it, they'll find it and go, wow, I found this really cool deal. I'm gonna go home and play it. But you know it doesn't work because the divers will find it and they'll just flip it later.
Yep. So, yeah, Goodwill is no good anymore for like that kind of thing, unless you like get there as the box gets there, you know?
Goodwill is good for like one thing, and that is Rock Band equipment if you're looking for it.
Yeah.
I've never even seen that. I see lots of copies of freaking like Monopoly though, or Sorry. Random board games, because even the video games there are usually pretty low tier, like accessories or otherwise.
I traded off my old Rock Band stuff because I didn't really play it anymore for an Earthbound strategy guide.
Nice.
Among some other things.
Yeah, Rock Band stuff is pretty pricey now. It's a bummer.
It wasn't at the time, but the Earthbound strategy guide was, so yeah. That's why I had to trade something.
I think Earthbound is still more valuable than Rock Band, but it's getting close if you have a full band.
Wow. Well, that means that I'm not going to be playing anymore Rock Band. Simple as that.
I mean, sometimes I do miss not having my copy of Rock Band anymore, but I mean,
for now, you never opened it.
Well, the reason I didn't open it was because I couldn't get the band back together. Like, I bought the game specifically because I wanted to get all my friends back together to play the game with me, but it didn't happen because, you know, the reason why we all split off in the first place, they all got married and had kids. Not the marriage part so much, but the kids was what really was like, yep, yeah, we're not having those parties anymore. So,
it has online play. We could have played, Purnell. We could have played. Man.
I mean, I appreciate the gesture, but it's not the same. Having everybody in the room yelling at each other, doing the tour mode and all that stuff, you can't replicate that on the internet. Got to be in person. So, since we couldn't set that up and get it going, the game sat there, became wasted potential. And I was like, well, I can either cross my fingers that they'll want to play once their kids are all 10 years old, or I can get myself $1,000 right now to let it go. Of course I took the damn money. So, c'est la vie. But
you wouldn't take the money for Magic Knight Ray Earth.
Because I can play Magic Knight Ray Earth by myself. I don't need but people will you? For that to get the experience. Yeah, I have. I've been on like a freaking retro game spree lately, especially when I come across ones that I'm learning are worth money. Tales of Destiny's worth $300. Yeah, I'm playing that shit. Tales of Destiny 2's worth $500. Playing that too. All those expensive games that people are like, oh man, I got a shrink wrapped on my shelf. It's worth $700. I'm like, well, I'm not. I have it opened. I've beaten it. I'm playing it again. It might not be worth anything, but I like the game, so I don't give a shit. But Rock Band's different because that game, though I like playing it, the true value in that game comes from playing it with my friends. And without that component, I don't need it.
The true Rock Band is the friendships we made along the way.
And it's true, which is why I still have the memories of it playing, what was that song, Rob the President at freaking PAX East. And like the harmonics guys ran to me, like, no one ever picks that song. We love that song. I'm like, really? Oh my God, I love that song too. So it was like the one time I bonded with the harmonic staff. It was a really fun time. But yeah, like that kind of stuff, I'll never forget. But it's unfortunate. It's just a part of being older, or I ain't gonna say older, because if I had older friends who also still liked all the stuff, age wouldn't matter. But it's unfortunate. It's just a part of how it goes. So, but I'm okay with it now. It's just as it is. So, what about you guys? Do you guys have any like local gaming collectives that you can just like call up on a moment's notice to have a gaming get together?
No,
fucking no.
Definitely not.
Left Buffalo.
I don't have friends, Purnell. Like you and Jake coming up was the first human interaction I had since MAGFest.
Well, you know, I guess I'm actually probably fucking due. Me and a few of the boys, from the scattered across Western New York, usually get together. We were pre-pandemic, it was like every like 6 months, 6, 8, 9 months, we'd get together. And now, well, we got together last June. We actually didn't play any games because we were just catching up. But yeah, maybe I should put that energy out into the world to be like, hey, let's get in the room. Let's get in a room and play some video games, boys.
Because I mean, it's something to be said. Like, I will admit, I am so glad we have online gaming because it does allow us to play games with people that we usually wouldn't be able to do so with. But it can't replace the in-person stuff. And unfortunately, as we get older and our families become families and all that stuff, you find yourself having to work harder to get any of those interactions together. Like, hell, even conventions used to be like a regular thing for me. Like, conventions where people played video games, not just ran around glomping each other and wearing signs and shit. Like, people played games. Now no one does that anymore either. So I was like, that was the point. So
I don't know. I saw a few people playing games at MAGFest.
That makes one of us, because none of my friends generally play, unless it's the Pokemon tournaments, my friends generally don't even play games there anymore. It's just going there, doing the concerts, wearing costumes, getting drunk, which I'm amazed they can still do, because the older we get, the less hurts. My stomach ain't holding shit like that anymore. Drinking's fun, but it ain't excessive drinking ain't worth a damn anymore. So screw that noise. But I digress. We do need to do like more like general get-togethers or something like that. I don't know how, but
well, Purnell, get to BitGen. I'll see you there.
Yeah, I am going, so you'll see me. It's gonna be just like old times, getting in the car, riding home at 5 a.m. Like, oh shit, look at the sun. Time to go home. That's tradition for me at this point. I kind of like it.
Yeah, I am. I'm looking forward to BitGen. If people are interested in BitGen, check out BitGenGamerFest.com. And stay tuned, because later in July, we're going to have a handful of people who are performing at BitGen coming on the show to chat with us and hang out. So, Pernell, you might want to clear your schedule for the 21st and join, because I know you like chatting music.
I do like chatting music. I also like popping music.
Yeah, and if anyone else wants to join, fuck it. Join in, because that's how our show is now. You could just join the fuck in.
At least us.
Yeah. True. We have the power. Just hop right in and out of the
podcast. You have the power.
That has almost happened several times. But it was like, I don't know whether it was last week or the week before, where you moved it from Thursday to Friday, and I was like, I can't make it anymore. But at some point,
oh, man.
You'll know when I'm there. I'll just say that.
You'll come busting in. Oh, geez. But speaking of things that are older and have online play, should we get to the reviews?
Shit. Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
That's a good one, right?
Let's do it.
All right, let's get to reviews. First game to talk about tonight is Capcom Fighting Collection, developed and published by Capcom, released June 24th on Xbox One, Switch, PS4, and PC for $39.99. 10 of Capcom's most popular arcade games in one epic collection. A wide variety of titles are included, from iconic series such as Street Fighter and Darkstalkers.
Half of them are from fucking Darkstalkers. Come on. Like, wide. I mean, there's some weird stuff, too, but, like... Go on.
Cyberbots and the first home console port of Red Earth. And of course, all titles support online play. This is a perfect collection for both arcade veterans who remember the titles and those who want to get into them for the first time. Tim, how is your time with Capcom Fighting Collection?
Good. I feel like it's a kind of game I'd want to bust out when I have people in my house to play some old fighting games together.
Which we've just established will not happen.
While you guys were talking about something, I looked up, I found the group chat, and I sent a message to it. So,
oh wow, okay, I stand.
Yes, make it happen. Yeah. One of us has to pull this off. It should be you. Get it out. Get it done.
All it takes, you know, somebody messages the chat. Like,
I respect any and all multitasking during the podcast recording.
Yeah. I mean, like, once Pernell goes off on a tangent, I know I got like 10, 15 minutes, but anyways, Capcom Fighting Collection actually also features some games that I did play with people in person, over the years, several of them, in fact. So this is a collection of 10 games. What I would say the big draw factor here is that all games have network play built into them, and it is the good netcode that I always harp on every time I'm reviewing a fighting game, that being rollback netcode, which is the netcode you want and works really well. And I've, you know, at least seen people chattering on to, I did not specifically play with someone from the West Coast, but I know people from the East Coast who have played with people on the West Coast and had great experiences. So that's what you want to hear. Good, stable online for playing your games with people. I mean, maybe I played with people from the West Coast. I actually don't know. I just can't specifically speak to it. So the games you have on here, and maybe I'll go into, yeah. So there are, as I mentioned, there are 5 Darkstalkers games. Not all of the Darkstalkers games, not all the versions of Darkstalkers, but 5 of them, and 2 of them of which, 2 variants we never saw here in the US. So you have the original Darkstalkers, the Night Warriors. You have Night Warriors, Darkstalkers Revenge. It's probably my personal favorite. Played a lot of that on Saturn at one particular get-together. We played a bunch of Night Warriors. And then I sold it, because that game was worth quite a bit. Darkstalkers 3, which is the... Well, it's called Vampire Savior World of Darkness, but I had Darkstalkers 3 on PlayStation. And then 2 other games, Vampire Hunter 2, Darkstalkers Revenge, and Vampire Savior 2, The Lord of Vampire, which are 2 variations on Vampire Savior with a different cast. One has rolls it back to the cast of Night Warriors, and the other switches out some characters. They were only released in Japanese arcades, so we have not seen those 2 versions here in the US, so they are not terribly different. I'm sure most of the play is going to be on just Vampire Savior, Darkstalkers 3. Like, of the Darkstalkers games, that's probably the one that people are going to be playing the most online. But, you know, those other two were interesting curiosities. It does not have Vampire Chronicle for Matching Service, which is the Dreamcast game, which is kind of an amalgamation of, like, all of those Darkstalkers games. But oh well, it would have been cool. Probably no one was thinking about that version of the game except for me, because I own it. It is right here behind me on my shelf.
Is it worth a lot?
I don't think so. Well, actually, aside here, most Japanese versions of Dreamcast games are worth way less than their North American counterparts, which is why I have a lot of Japanese versions of Dreamcast games. Same game. Yeah, it's in Japanese, but a lot of them are so arcadey, it doesn't matter. Anyways, I mean, they still go up in value, but they're, you know, the North American versions are like worth two or three times more, just because the collecting group is more North American centric. Other games on this collection, other than, you know, you get the five Darkstalkers, you have Super Puzzle Fighter 2 Turbo, which fucking rules, just in case you didn't know. That is a versus puzzle game that uses, yeah,
that
like
was a cool one to see in this collection. That caught me by surprise.
Yeah. Not strictly a fighting game. Yes, Puzzle Fighter, but yeah, it is a gem matching game. You build up gems, you explode them, you destroy your enemy. It is a great, great versus puzzler, which I played tons and tons of back in the day. I'm actually quite good at it. Or at least I used to. I'm probably not so much anymore. Super Gem Fighter Mini Mix, also known as Pocket Fighter here in North America, which takes the little chibi characters from Puzzle Fighter and puts them into a fighting game. Not the maybe the most high-level intensive fighting game, but it is a lot of fun. Also played a lot of that back in the day. And Cyberbots Full Metal Madness, which I played that recently. I'm guessing it's on that Capcom collection thing, that's arcade collection that's on Xbox and PlayStation stuff, where you can like buy games a la carte.
That's something that I'll a point that we'll get to in a few minutes, but yeah, that's on there.
That was on there. So That's a fairly recent thing. Not a very, very recently released thing is Red Earth, which is the first time it's getting a home port. And I was sitting there like kind of racking my brain. I'm like, have I played that game on something that wasn't an emulator? Like, did it come out on anything? Like, just trying to think if it was on like some collection back for PlayStation or Xbox or whatever. And turns out, no, it has never been released. And probably because it's a weird fucking game. and that, like, well, it's like there's only four playable characters in it, so it's like a versus fighting game. You're kind of like, well, that's not very much. But as a single player fighting game, like, it is way interesting and different, because it's just basically like a fighting game boss rush, but you're like upgrading your characters, and like the bosses are like these big, like, I don't know, it's just like really cool looking characters that they drew for this game, and like fun, weird stuff going on with it. And happy to have it here at home. I don't expect people are going to be playing a lot of that online. And of course, an obligatory Street Fighter game, this being Hyper Street Fighter 2, the Anniversary Edition, which was originally on a Street Fighter collection for PS2. It is sort of the Vampire Chronicle for Matching Service version of the Street Fighter games, in that it just like amalgamates everything from Street Fighter 2 through Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo into one game. And like when you select a character, you can select which version of Street Fighter you want the character to be from. You can get to that level of detail. So it's just, you know, a fun kind of everything thrown in there version of Street Fighter. Because God forbid you have a collection without a Street Fighter on there. But every game except for the two every game has North American and Japanese versions, except for, of course, the two Darkstalkers games that never had North American versions. So there's that. When you go in there, so the game has your offline mode and your online mode. When you go and you select a game to kind of queue up for online mode, you can do it for either version of the game. Because, I mean, once you're in versus, who cares? You can set it to just look for matches while you're playing a game, while you're sitting there on the menu, and it'll just like kind of match you up. It will literally say, "Here comes a new challenger." And what's nice is you can queue for I would queue for Puzzle Fighter, and then I was like playing Darkstalkers. So you can mix and match. Yeah, you can just mix and match what you're playing, which is kind of a silly thing to do, I guess. Just like, well, I want to play competitively in this one game, but I actually feel like playing this other game right now for whatever reason. There's a bit of kind of, I don't want to overly downplay it, but pretty unremarkable museum stuff, you know, just like some art is in there. I do appreciate that on the old, they built in move lists to all the games, because that would not have been standard in those games at the time, so none of them would have had it, but now they do. It's just there in kind of the overall games menu, so that is very cool, and it's smart, so it's not like a generic menu, so it will pull up the character you are playing as in Darkstalkers or whatever to read up about it. Yeah, I think that's everything.
Hey, I think one issue that we do have to bring up, you mentioned Cyberbots being in Arcade Collection.
Yeah.
Let me ramble off a few titles here. Darkstalkers, okay. The Night Warriors, Night Warriors, Darkstalkers Revenge, yep. Super Puzzle Fighter 2 Turbo, Vampire Savior, The Lord of Vampire, Super Gem Fighter Mini Mix, Hyper Street Fighter 2, The Anniversary Edition. Mm-hmm. I read those off of Capcom Arcade Stadium second bundle.
Yeah.
Six games are in Capcom's Arcade Second Stadium.
Yep.
That's a lot of double dipping.
Well, Capcom, let me introduce you to a company called Capcom. That's what they do. They, you know, they grab their games and repackage them over and over again. I'm not sure what the net code that other thing uses, I'm assuming it has some, but yeah, I get that's just kind of, I guess, you know, be aware, their prospective buyer. But this is, you know, this is a fighting game package that it seems like people are picking up and playing. So,
well, the package runs at $39.99. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's worth it. If the online was shit, it wouldn't be, but it is. And it's, in my opinion, it's a good mix of games. Like, I love Darkstalkers. Like, any chance to highlight Darkstalkers and give Darkstalkers love is great, because everybody wants a new modern Darkstalkers game and is never going to get it. sadly. But, you know, having Puzzle Fighter on there, having Pocket Fighter on there, which is a cool game, Red Earth, the first release of Red Earth, that is something special. So, yeah, I think it's totally worth it. Yeah, the only thing that should give you pause is, like, well, how many times do you want to own these games? But, you know what? In another 5 years or 6 years, we'll have another generation of consoles or another Nintendo system, and they'll be releasing it for that, and we'll go through this.
You'll be buying them all over again. So.
Or they'll be repackaging, you know, they'll be doing another repackaging, so it'll be like, oh, you know, like a 90s Capcom fighting smorgasbord with some amount of games on there, and you'll be like, why isn't this on there?
I just really want two new games, and you'll buy the set of 40 games for like $79.99.
Well, the thing is that if they ever figure out the legality of doing like a versus release that has Children of the Atom and Marvel Super Heroes and X-Men versus Street Fighter, etc., on one collection, that would be awesome. Yeah. That's the thing I want more than anything. But obviously there's the worst media company in the world to deal with between Capcom and that happening. But you know, a boy can dream. Yeah. Give me Children of the Atom, or give me like Children of the Atom through Marvel versus Capcom 1. I don't even need Marvel versus Capcom 2, though you might as well while you're doing it. But yeah, up through Marvel versus Capcom, I'll be happy. But This collection also made me happy. It is something I will bust out. Should my plan come together of seeing friends in person.
Nice. Well, I am glad that
I got one confirmation.
You got one. Nice. That is more than I have.
Well, so. I got one that like down, but we have to figure out a date, and that's the hard part.
Yeah, scheduling's always fun.
Yeah. Well, it's like, it's especially during the summer when it's a bunch of fucking dads, and like, you know, everybody has different summer vacation plans and their wives are doing this that night and doing this some other night. And, you know, the calendar fills up quick, especially if your spouse is like a 10-month employee at a school and, this is their vacation where they get to do fuck all everything.
Which that's Ashley this week. Ashley's on vacation this week, and
yeah, me too.
Getting to enjoy it. Well, I hope you enjoy your vacation. Do you have any final thoughts before we move on?
Yeah, no, I think I'll stick around and listen to what Purnell has to say about Disgaea 6 at least, because I don't got to be up tomorrow. I'm on vacation.
Cool. Well,
nice.
Next game to talk about is Disgaea 6, developed by Nippon Ichi Software, published by NIS America, released June 28th on PS4, PS5, and PC $59.99. Join Zed in his quest to rise above his lowly status and challenge a god of destruction. Along the way, meet zany characters, explore chaotic new worlds, and discover the power of sibling bonds and determination. Purnell, tell us about your time spent with this one.
Did I review this game? I feel like I reviewed this game.
Did you review it on Switch?
Maybe, yes. I think so, yeah. Like a year ago, maybe.
Yeah, you definitely, that bullshit. You're pretty sure you did the PS, no, you did the Switch version, and then the PS5 version and 4 and all that came later.
Yeah, now.
Okay, now I remember.
Here it is.
Ta-da! So, get this point out of the way and just be done with it. At least in my personal take, I didn't find this one to be as good in the overall package as the earlier games. With that said, however, I originally kind of went into this with a chip on my shoulder, expecting it to not even be good. If anybody is a fan of Disgaea and been following the news, they already know why I'm thinking that. However, having
and if
played
they're
the
not
game,
following the news?
Yeah, why? What are you talking about?
Well, that's where the review is going to come in. I don't. If they haven't been following it, they don't care about that part. But they'll care about what I have to say next, which is the fact that having played the game, I came away with a bit of a different opinion on it overall. So the plot of this game is essentially about a zombie character named Zed, who, for reasons that the narrative eventually reveals to you, is on a sort of one-track mind course to defeat the God of Destruction, which is basically a being that travels from netherworld to netherworld and just destroys them because he can or something. So his goal is to defeat this thing by his own hands. However, he is weak and is pretty much incapable of doing so until he makes a specific deal to make use of a very specific spell that allows him to reincarnate indefinitely until he achieves his goal. It's kind of funny if they did it this way, because it kind of takes a game mechanic that the series has always had and they turn it into an actual plot device, that being the form of character reincarnation. So every time he fights the God of Destruction and loses, he gets reincarnated in a new netherworld, basically one that the God of Destruction is going to be at, because that's how the spell works. And he supposedly retains all of his strength from the previous run, and he gets to try again. Of course, it wouldn't be a Disgaea game if he didn't change that up a bit by having him do things like meet cool, interesting characters on each of his transitions, and then they end up coming along with him after he dies, and he gets to do it again and again. So the narrative in that regard is actually pretty fun and interesting, and I like the character that he ends up meeting. I could do without the character that sings all the time, though she is still kind of cool. It's just I wish she wouldn't sing a lot of the time. And my favorite character, of course, is the freaking king who gives up. He's the rich king who's obsessed with money. And I gotta love that character. He all of his attacks involve some form of like excessive wealth, and he talks in the form of like how he can use excessive wealth to like manipulate people. It's a good character. It's better than he sounds, that put it that way.
So speaking of things that are better than they sound, I was wrong on the price. The game is not $59.99. It is $69.99.
Oh, PS5 version, but I think it got to the PC. PS4 also as a
PC is $69.99 as well. PS4 and PS5s together.
$69.
Yeah. That caught me by surprise. I did not expect that.
the PS5 version I expected, but I didn't realize they were like only sold together like that. But as far as the narrative goes, that's just done. It just happens. Every time the gameplay takes place on each level, it has a narrative based around it. At the end of every stage, you fight the god Destruction and you beat him, but then you lose because narrative, and then you do it again. And at first I was kind of annoyed by that because I kind of think it's dumb that you have to fight the same boss over and over again. But at the same time, I realized that for the most part, the Sky games have never really been good with boss fights, except for the post-game stuff. So I just kind of was like, eh, it's a means to an end. Just let Whaley, this jerk, and be done with it. So I'm going to stop talking about the narrative itself now and talk about the mechanics, because that's the really big shakeup of this game that the game had, aside from the whole switch to 3D, which I guess I'll also mention eventually. So a few changes that they made to this game. The weirdest one being that they made it so that stats kind of don't matter anymore. Or rather, they do, but you can't really tell. What I mean by that is, typically when you play a game, you start from the bottom, level 1, and your numbers are somewhat reasonable. Like, you got 100 attack power, 200 defense, whatever, and as you get equipment, it goes up. Well, in this game, you'll get equipment, and your stats will continue to go up. But you already start with exorbitantly high numbers. So, from what I remember, my very first attack did like 25,000 damage.
Oh, jeez.
And I didn't understand why. It just said 25K. You go to the stat menu, all your stats are like five figures. And it's just like comically big numbers. Now, you might be saying to yourself, and I won't lie, when Tim originally reviewed this game, I was like, is it really that hard to understand this? I'm not used to this. No, it really is that hard to understand to an extent. When I equip items in this game now, all I see is blue number goes up and red number means down. Those are how I configure my stats. As you level up, you'll just see larger and larger numbers, eventually get to like 10-digit numbers. It's ridiculous. You still have elements like the getting items that come with different ranks. So like a legendary weapon, a rare weapon, or a basic weapon, which then can be utilized in something called the item world. For those who are unfamiliar with Disgaea mechanics, the item world is a thing where every item in the game has a quote-unquote dungeon inside of it, and you can run the dungeon to increase the stats of the weapon. Basic weapons should have like 30 floors, rare 50, and legendary of 100. And, well, the further down you go, the stronger the weapon gets. So you'll find yourself doing that a lot if you find yourself wanting to really max out your character stats to do like anything like post-game content. Really, if you're doing just the base story, you really won't even have to care about that. But you'll be making use of that kind of thing. But since, again, the numbers seem to have so little meaning, you just kind of do it in the same sense. Like, okay, I just want a better weapon, though I don't know how much better it is. I don't really care. And it's still kind of fun to do that. So the numbers are weird. I don't understand them, but that's neither here nor there. The team-up attacks, which used to be, if you get characters next to each other and you do an attack, they'll have this really cool animation related to it. They kind of did away with the animation part. So it's just like, if your character is standing next to the enemy, you'll get the slash bar that has their character portraits, and you'll see the damage come up. And one interesting aside to that was, due to them getting rid of that animation, they are more generous with the bonuses. So it might be an archer three tiles back attacking an enemy four ahead, but since one of your characters is still next to the enemy, he counts it on your team up, despite the fact that he's not standing next to you or anything. Something that didn't work in the other game. You can't do tower attacks anymore. They got rid of that. They got rid of all like the tower based abilities too. So because of course you can still lift and throw people though. So that's nifty. They also reduced the character class construction by a lot. My understanding was they wanted to streamline a little bit more so people weren't overwhelmed with the option of choice, because you'd have like a male and female version of like every class and their stats would differ slightly. So it wasn't just cosmetic and you were trying to figure out which ones announced. It's like, nope, it's just one warrior and there's one cleric and there's one mage and so on and so forth. They reduced the types of monster totals up there too. So they reduce things, but the gameplay itself is still enjoyable to me. So believe it or not, despite my concerns about those things, the gameplay has still been proving itself to be fun to me. Tempe Sato's music is still a gem. It's been a good time. The one major annoyance I've come across, though, is the attack animations. So I guess this is Nipponichi's first attempt at 3D character models. Up until now, all of their games have done like variations of 2D character models because that's what they excelled at. That was a part of which when that was mainly what their claim to fame was, really. So this is their chance to try to break away from that, and the results are a little bit mixed. When you do the special attacks, I don't know what they were thinking here, but the camera zooms in really close on all the special attacks. So you miss, I personally feel like you miss out on a number of elements that would actually make the attack look better if you could see it more, like with the camera panned out more. But it's a weird thing. I don't know why they did it. Maybe it was an accident. I don't even know. It just seems like, were they trying to hide some aspect of the 3D modeling? I don't know. But I wish they had an option that lets you pan the camera back out. And if someone's listening and they're like, actually, Perno, we added one for Disgaea 5 Complete. Please tell me, and I'll go ahead and select it, and I'll be happy because of that. But as it was, I was kind of annoyed by that. But
that'd be weird if they added it to Disgaea 5 Complete since you're reviewing Disgaea 6 Complete.
Ah. Yeah, I know. You got me. That's what happens when I get 4 hours of sleep at night.
Speaking of it being complete, it is mostly complete. It includes all of the DLC recolor stuff, as well as previously released character and cosmetic DLC. But there are some additional power-up DLC boosts available that you could drop like $2-3 on if you want. Nothing required, but they're there if you want them.
I'm glad you said that too, because there is one other pretty major element that I should likely mention, though it can be take it or leave it depending on how much time you got for the game to be played. So also a first for the Disgaea series that this game decided to do was he created a sort of gambit system akin to like what Final Fantasy 12 did. It starts out small. It's a little grid. It's like a sort of like a 20, like a bunch of, it's a big grid. I don't know how many tiles it has, but it's a really big grid. And you can kind of set up options to say things like, if make a character go here if he has this much HP, and when he's next to an enemy, do special attack or something like that. And you can set up these elaborate chains of commands for the characters to do, and then set it to auto battle, and they'll just do it based on the macros you've programmed. I have mixed feelings about this, because on one hand, unless he has multiple hands, there's going to be a lot of hands here. On one hand, you have the aspect that by them putting in, yes, going to be an octopus. It kind of insinuates that they expect you to utilize auto battle in this game, which kind of makes me sad, because though I get the game has always been a factor of grinding, never wanted to really be a matter of just let the game play itself. So that's just what we do now. So I feel kind of weird about that. On the other hand, though, I liked it in Final Fantasy XII when you could run around an environment and have these cool gambits programmed for all of your party members, so that the goal for you, the player, would be to program the ultimate gambit to say, if I come across a battle scenario, I want this to account for every scenario I come across, and not have to feel like I couldn't master the game, essentially. So it was something fun about making these perfectly mechanical characters that perform as you would have technically performed, but without your input. There's something oddly cool, but maybe because it's the whole programming thing. I don't know. I like computer programming. But I think that part is cool. Whether or not a player will actually go through the process of even going through all of that, though, it's hard to say, because it does seem more complicated than it actually is, even if the game itself goes through a number of tutorials trying to make it very clear that it's not complicated. Like the main character goes, hey Zed, you want to do this thing? It's really not hard. And he goes, I don't want to do it. My zombie brain can't handle it. He's like, come on, man, it's really easy. Like, it's surprising how hard they want you to realize how simple it is, but it can seem complicated if you're not much to want to engage in that aspect of the game. But I mean, it can be taken or left, but it can rub people either way, but it's not a requirement. That's the important part. It's just a feature. So yeah, don't feel too bad about it if it's not your cup of tea.
No, though,
I would say I was getting to the final. You only have to do it. I'm getting there too. at the end of the day, despite the fact that the game did remove some elements of gameplay to it compared to previous entries in the series, mostly Disgaea 5, I still find the game to be enjoyable. The merits that it does bring to the table are enjoyable to engage in, and I do believe it would be nice to see them take what they've learned here, hopefully from listening to what player input has been, and make a better Disgaea 7, or even if they expand this technology into their future, get to their future non-Disgaea 3D tactical games. I'd like to see them do more with this, but as it stands, as like a sort of, I don't know, 3D strategy RPG Nipponichi prototype, I think the game is fine. If $69.99 may not be your cup of tea, though, I mean, that's what sales are for. Wait it out a bit, but I think the game is fine.
All right, your official verdict, then?
I'd give it a hardcore try.
Sounds good.
Man, I want to play the Disgaea games. I only know one thing about them, though. There's, like, the dude in the one game that just says, yeah, yeah, dude. Do it, dude. You guys know what I'm talking about? It's the same franchise.
Oh, they're in every game. That's the Prinny.
Prinnies.
Oh, my God. So, like, I'll sit next to Carrie on the couch, and that guy will just keep going for it. And I'm like, that is me, man. I love that guy.
Really, dude?
One of the Prinnies have a couple of their own side games, and one of them is Operation Panties, dude.
Oh, awesome. Okay, Googling this now. Amazing.
I don't think I should Google Operation Panties during the show.
Yeah, let me take that hit.
If you do end up liking it, I think it got re-released on the Switch over the last few years, too, so you can get it on the Switch.
There's a Prinny collection. They were PSP games, but now they're Switch games.
Oh, okay.
Cool. Warning, I haven't played them myself, but apparently they're very difficult.
They're challenging, like platformers.
Yeah, they have settings. They do have settings that can make the game a bit easier for you. But it is a challenging franchise. One hit deaths, but you get 1,000 lives, but you'll burn through those lives. So,
wow, cool.
I'll have 1,000 lives as a penguin in hell. That's a great premise.
Searching for draws.
Well, speaking of games where you kind of have 1,000 lives, the next game to talk about is Wreckfest.
Oh, yes.
Nice.
Developed by Bugbear Entertainment, published by
THQ. All right, I'm going. Good night.
Good night, Tim.
Good night.
Published by THQ Nordic. Released June 21st on the Switch for $39.99. Wreckfest is jam-packed with upgrade and customization options, whether you're preparing for your next demolition derby with reinforced bumpers, roll cages, side protectors, and much more, or setting your car up for a banger race with engines, performance parts like air filters, camshafts, fuel systems, and more. Wreckfest is shaping up to be the best competitive motorsports game out there. Chris, tell us about your time with Wreckfest.
All right, me first. Okay, so Wreckfest. This is a combination demolition derby game as well as racing game. It is completely bonkers, and I love it. It's amazing. So basically, you have a couple of different modes here. You can do a career mode, which sees you, you know, like in most racing games of this ilk, like you basically have like different competitions that you can do. You can play them for points and try to get, you know, enough points to move on to the next kind of series of challenges, and they're varied. Like they go from everything from like the very first one, the lawnmower deathmatch challenge.
Yes,
where you are on, go ahead.
I knew I was in for a special game when that was the first event you did.
That's the first event, is where you are on a riding lawnmower against like 10, however many other people also on riding lawnmowers. And you got to be the one person that is still standing. And it's just like in a grassy field with like haystacks, like for walls. And actually it's very like fun to ride around on a lawnmower. And, here's where it gets like weird, is because like, okay, so the reward for winning this is that you get a lawnmower in your garage. You have a garage of cars that you earn, purchase, or purchase through DLC. And the lawnmower that gets added to your garage, unless it's like a very special event that only allows for like one kind of vehicle, you could just take that lawnmower and race against cars with it. That's kind of where the gold of this game like really is, like the diamond in the middle, is that whether it be through the like the career mode, you know, it's a little more on rails. However, you can actually put yourself into a custom event or multiplayer where you get to choose from a whole bunch of courses. And I mean, it's a lot of courses, and each course has different builds. So basically, like, okay, so if I choose, for instance, the very first course, which is Big Valley Speedway, I have 6 options for how I want to race this one course: as an open demolition area, just demolition area, a figure eight, inner oval, outer oval loop. So like they configure these to be basically shaped around the kind of game that you're going to play. So if the stage has an available open demolition area, you can then make, an actual death match, a last man standing, where you can, throw your, you know, one of your prize vehicles in there, or, you know, choose from some preset vehicles that you actually can't take into career mode, and they're just for basically this fun purpose. And you could just sit there and make a game where it's like last man standing, everybody on lawnmowers, that actually gives you experience points and money, both of which you can use to unlock new cars and customize them. So here's the crazy thing. I'm going to just jump straight to my very favorite part of this game, because I've been doing it this whole show. One of the vehicles... Huh?
Demolition Derby?
Yes, that's the setup, but here's the thing. The vehicles that I mentioned that are just like the vehicles that you basically get to play around with in these special events, some of them are like cars, and then you get like... And they... Each vehicle also has a class, so like, you know, a lawnmower and a motorhome, like, are considered like class C. There's some class C cars, there's class B cars, class A cars, you know, whatever. And again, that's for like special events where like only a certain class is allowed. But then you get like school buses and like, you know, little three-wheel vans. One of them is a sofa car, where it's just like a... It's just a nice sofa with wheels and like a desk. So it's like I imagine you're playing this on your sofa, like, and then your character in the game is also on a sofa. By the way, you can't really destroy anything with this sofa. It's extremely hard. Like, the game's pretty realistic in that sense, that a sofa with a desk attached to it and the steering wheel is not going to do as much damage as a school bus.
Awesome. Someone else survive in it.
Yeah, I mean, you can set everybody else to couches and then just see who can demolish the most couches with their couch. Here's the other thing. One of the vehicles is a combine harvester, a giant ass tractor that you would see like on like a real, like, you know, serious like farm, right? Yeah. It's got like the big thresher on the front. It's got the huge wheels, all that stuff. If you want, you can set up a death match where you have a harvester and everyone else has lawnmowers, and you could just basically watch them all go after each other and just kind of throw yourself in there like a nuclear bomb. This is something that you can do not only for fun, which, by the way, you get that like times 100, but it actually does give you like the experience points and money that you would need to like actually unlock like the better cars and customizations for the actual career mode. So like this has real utility, just throwing in these insane games where, you know, you're just kind of doing what you want. And again, the cars are great. None of them are licensed cars. And they're all like, you can see like, masking tape holding them together, duct tape, like you can see bungee cords. Like, you could tell these are cars that are just trash. And they still have, like, stats, you know, your acceleration, top speed, cornering, and strength. And, you know, they can still be customized, and you can build, you know, put guards on them and things like that, which is just kind of great. But you don't need to know about cars, because these are just junk. Or, like, farming implements, you know? So, yeah, well, this game...
One of the big things that we needed to focus on with this review, because it is a Switch port, is performance. Purnell, I know you played this as well. What did you think of the performance in the game?
Honestly, the performance wise, I didn't have any issues with it compared to the Xbox One version of it. The only thing I really noticed off the top was the Xbox version was like more colorful. Like, I did a few events on the Xbox version again just to refresh and went back. And the courses, when you play them, there's a lot more vibrant color and stuff on the Xbox. And then originally I thought that there was like some moments where on that lawnmower like crash course scenario, I'm wonder if Chris experienced this too. You'll like see, go say you'll be driving up to one guy, like, I'm gonna take this guy, I'm driving to him. And they'll just disappear. And you're wondering why. I, at first I thought that was a limitation on the Switch. Like, okay, maybe it's just loading up the guy having crashed and it's going to put him back to get respawn of the match or whatever. But the other versions were like that too. So as far as I could tell, aside from just, you know, graphical tricks and all, the game performed about the same.
Yeah, I think the game performs really well. Yeah, I think that that's when you're in the Demolition Derby, basically any time that your wheels like leave the ground or you slow down, you can push Y to restart your position, just in case you accidentally turned yourself around or something. And same thing with racing. It's like it's really good that way. That's actually something I really try to look for in racing games, is that, you know, crashing isn't too much of a consequence. In this, it's an actual like function. But yeah, I think that the computer vehicles also phase out. If you're like sitting there crunching them and stuff and they can't move, then they can reset themselves so that you can't just, you know, sit there and eat them alive, you know?
I had a really good video clip from the Xbox quite a while ago where a guy was coming right at me and I was respawning and I disappeared right as he went to hit me and he just plowed right into a wall.
Nice.
It was beautiful.
It was like
that guy had to be pissed off because he like I was gonna get crushed. Absolute perfect T-bone and I vanished right in front of him. Oh
well, so nice. This was a human player. It wasn't like a this wasn't a PC player.
Oh no, this was online. I love this. I am not someone who plays a lot of online games. I will play Wreckfest online because just doing online destruction derby is one of the most relaxing and cathartic things you could do in gaming.
Yeah, this game is super relaxing.
Which is kind of funny to hear that too, because like the content, the subject matter, you would think it'd be anything but. It's like, no, I feel kind of comfortable doing this.
Oh yeah, and like it's funny too, because like, you know, you think that the vehicles would disappear off the track once, you know, they're destroyed, but no, they stay there as an obstacle. If they're lawnmower riders, they're just gonna be on the ground dead. Those people are dead, and they're gonna stay dead.
The ragdoll physics are great too.
Yeah,
it is pointless to pick a lawnmower in Destruction Derby online, but some people will do it for the lulz, and I'll take them out and get points.
And kind of getting a little deeper into it, I'm kind of like, you know, I can see where one of these guys can actually do some damage, because the thing is that's cool about it is that each vehicle has destruction points that they can lose. So if you ram too many things, not in the combine harvester because it's got that big tool in the front, but like in a car, if you ram too many things with your front bumper, that front bumper goes away and it's just your exposed engine and you can't bump into things like that anymore. It doesn't do any damage. So just throw that thing in reverse and start trying to back into everybody is the strategy at that point. So it's like there is something to be said about kind of using something as nimble as a lawnmower to pick apart like certain parts of a vehicle, because you can really get around on those things. I mean, I'm not that good yet, but
no lawnmowers.
Like I've definitely been thinking. Yeah, I've definitely been thinking about that while chewing up about 100,000 of them today. So,
well, the game is sitting at $40 on the Switch. What are your thoughts?
I not only say buy it, there is a ton of DLC, like including two separate packs of like vehicles and stuff, and I'm going to say buy this and buy those, because that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, the DLC is mostly just like different cars and cosmetics you could get. I know the one pack, I think it just let me put a giant turd on the top of my car, and what more do you need?
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, that is not without its value.
Yeah, you could put like a rubber duck on there. They have different car packs with ridiculous vehicles.
Yeah, I truly love this
bumper
game.
Car. And like,
maybe it's something to be said about like my history of like my favorite racing games, because it's always stuff like Rock and Roll Racing, which lets you shoot, you know, an RC program, which lets you shoot missiles at other cars. Excite Truck, which gives you bonus points for crunching into other cars. Apparently, I like racing games when you can just utterly destroy people and not with blue shells. Yeah.
They're fun. And I just looked it up. The Backwoods Bangers car pack is $4. It lets you drive an outhouse.
There we go. Perfect.
So
that's awesome.
Outhouse versus lawnmower. Let's go.
Round one fight. Pernell, your thoughts? $40.
I mean, honestly, I still believe it's a solid buy. I've heard more than a few people wax nostalgic of Destruction Derby way back in the day. And as far as I'm concerned, this is very much a modern and better Destruction Derby. So it's a good time. It's worth the money. Just have a little dumb fun with some great content.
And if you're on the fence, it is part of Xbox Game Pass.
Oh, there it is.
Yes. Hey, can't go wrong with Game Pass, man.
It's a good product. It really is.
Yeah, buddy.
Best deal in gaming.
You got to get it, Chris. We need to get you an Xbox. Brooke, we need to get you an Xbox. 31. We need to get you on the Game Pass train.
Yeah, I need to replace my Xbox. I just finally replaced my PS Vita, so and I'm going to be hitting you guys up next show for our chat portion for some Vita.
You replaced the Vita, or you or
I bought it. I used to have a Vita, and I had an Xbox, and I have like both. One was lost, and one was broken with time. So next stop is getting an Xbox.
I got you.
It's happening.
Well, you know what else is happening? The next review is happening. Because the next game to talk about is Tales of Aragorn, Seasons of the Wolf, developed by Winter Wolves, published by Rattlake Games, released June 17th on Xbox One, Series X and S, Switch, PS4, and PS5 for $19.99. In this role-playing game, you'll play as Shay or Althea, twins from the faraway village of Ninim. In just the course of 1 year, you'll experience many storylines and side quests, situations and events where your own choices influence the very end of the game. Brooke, how did you influence the very end of the game?
Ooh, I didn't finish the game, first of all, so I guess I'm in big trouble with Joe now. This game's pretty cool. I am fired. I like Dang a lot of the things fired. This game Fuck has it. Going on. But let me, one last job and I'm out. Let me do this final review and then I'll be fired. I like a lot of the things this game has going on. I'm a big Dragon Age fan, big Heroes of Might and Magic 2 fan. I also love visual novels and I'm seeing a fair amount of influences from all three of these in here. I'm also recovering from COVID, so I'm going to be taking breaks to sip a drink. Just heads up. Okay, one sip down. So you're playing as one of two twins. You're going to pick which one at the beginning of the game that you want to be you. One of them's a guy, one of them's a girl. I know they both sound kind of like lady names. The other one becomes an NPC in your party. Character creation's pretty deep and cool, more than I expected. Towards the end of rolling your character, you even pick like a couple small backstories for your character out of like a multiple choice type situation of little stories you can pick for them towards the end of character creation that determine more of their like style and skill. Sort of like they do in, I think it's like Mass Effect or Mass Effect 2, where you can pick little tiny stories at the beginning of character creation, which is really neat. I like that touch a lot. You'll also accumulate different party members later on for combat and such, depending on the different social choices you make. And there are a lot of choices in this game. I typically always like this sort of thing. What I like about Dragon Age games is your party feels alive. They kind of talk to each other as you go around the world and as the story progresses. You can have your other player character date other NPCs in the game if you happen to be that NPC's cup of tea, gender or taste-wise. That's always really cool. Another thing I appreciated about this game are the encounters all have, like, procedurally generated elements and the dialogue that happens during confrontations and encounters and how enemies behave during each battle are random as well. I know this for sure because I loaded up this game, played it for about an hour, got through the first few encounters, and then the game crashed with a mysterious fatal switch error. I had foolishly not yet saved my game initially, so I started over and took it from the top. That's okay. And this is the only error I had like that the entire game. But what's good about that is I know for sure just how random some of the encounters and dialogue really are. And it is quite different. First time around, not only did different encounters happen and different things happen in those encounters, but the first time around, one twin in my party could not stop talking. And I thought the other twin was just like quiet as part of their character and just didn't talk. Second time getting through the first hours of the game, it was super different. Both twins spoke a fair amount, but it was definitely the opposite one that talked way more than the other one when I went back and got caught back up to the first place of my place I lost. Speaking of twins and NPCs talking, the voice acting in this game is really decent. I liked all the voices that I heard. I also really, really liked the music of the game a great bit. This game has really good fantasy adventure type soundtrack from the parts that I played at least. And I didn't finish this game, but what I did play, I enjoyed the story of and the characters quite a great deal. I even found the game had a good little sense of humor to it too, also kind of like Dragon Age does, especially when it comes to different recurring NPCs. in the game, and then in the beginning of the game too. Nice vibes going on there. What I didn't like about the game is the interface that comes up when you do combat. Unless you're using touchscreen exclusively for all combat, unfortunately, this is just the worst combat interface that I've ever played with. It's Ouch. Just really confusing. Nothing is clear. And even after you've kind of figured out how it works, which the tutorial doesn't really help with, in my opinion, it's just kind of senselessly difficult and counterintuitive to navigate around. I'm going to paste in a link to an image to the Twitch chat so I can kind of illustrate to our little chatties here. So if you pull this up, look at Althea. What'd you say? Sorry.
I said we should call our audience the Smellies, because SML.
Ooh, nice. I like that. Okay. So if you're playing as Althea and you're trying to attack the Grey Wolf, if that snow spider wasn't there, or there's any kind of space, you can't just sort of click to the right and then up. You have to keep clicking right and kind of have it run out of space, and then eventual clicks will let you just get up to the top row. I don't know if I'm doing a good job of explaining how much of a pain this is, but it's just kind of impossible to figure out. It's just really strange. I just kind of get the feeling that the developers don't even know that it's being optimized like this for Switch, because it doesn't make any sense. It's really strange. Let me find my place here, because I tabbed over. This isn't nearly as much of a problem if you do all touchscreen, but if you do choose that route to go all touchscreen, you're just not going to be able to play it on a larger screen. You're not going to be able to lean back on your couch with your controller in hand and look at it on a big screen, which is how I want to play it. I like that Switch lets you do handheld or TV on a monitor when you want to do on the couch, but I bought the Switch so I can do both, and I definitely prefer the latter. And one thing I really don't like is when a game basically only lets you play one of the two ways, but it doesn't say that clearly before you purchase the game. In this instance, even just making you figure it out yourself mid-combat, that something's not working, how am I going to work around it? I had that happen with this game, and I had that happen with Ashwalkers, which we reviewed for the Switch on the show a while back. In both this game and Ashwalkers, I do come away with a strong feeling that neither the creators of the game designed this game that way at all, or would how it has ended up. I know this game came out on Steam a couple years ago, I think. I don't know if this game has controller support on Steam, but if it does, I'm pretty confused as to why the Switch controller would be configured like this and sort of force touchscreen that way rather than make it almost unplayable. So
I'm wondering how it holds up on PlayStation and on Xbox as well.
I actually, I didn't realize that it was coming out on PlayStation and Xbox 2, so I'm super curious how that's going to happen, since those, we don't have touchscreens for that, so I'm really, really, really curious. So maybe this is just a Switch optimization thing. I hope so, because I can see this being a really fun game that does serve a niche market that has a clear need and not a ton of games for it. Sadly, my opinion of the interface as it is currently so low. I don't find this to be a super playable Switch game in its current condition. For the price, I'm not sure that this is going to be worth it to the average modern game player, unless that player knows up front they can basically only play it if they buy it, if they feel comfortable playing it in that handheld mode only. And optimally, they need to find that out before they buy it. If they're not finding that out in the Switch eShop somehow before purchasing, then in its current form, I can only see them charging between $7 to $10 for this, really. If this were more in the $7 to $10 range, even with the issues, I can see calling it a try it, because I really do think that this could be a fun game. But at, I think this is $20 in the Switch shop now. And I know it's on sale for 30% off right now, but at either price, I do have to call this a deny it. It makes me sad to call it that, because if the issue with the playability of the game is somehow fixed, I'm happily amending this review to be an enthusiastic try it. Specifically, a try it exactly for players like me, big Dragon Age, big Biznot fans who definitely don't mind 2D art and a couple other aspects of the game being a little rough around the edges for a really great story and a unique experience with lots of replayability.
I see what you did there. Time.
Personally, I'm going to do some research, find out if I can comfortably play this with a controller on the couch from Steam instead of on Switch, and just for me, keep an eye on it to go heavily on sale, and then I may very well buy this for my own fun use. I got this game for free for the show from Joe. I have a ton of games in my horrifying rat king of a backlog.
Really you think you have a lot. That's adorable.
So that really compliment to the content. From me, as a consumer, I do want to be able to play this game and games like it, but that's as far as I can go as far as repping for this game, as it is.
Sounds fair. I was excited and kind of looking forward to this one, but it sounds like I might have to wait for a sale or wait for someone else to chime in on how it plays on Xbox.
Yeah, or even, you know, if they get enough feedback like mine, and I'm sure they will if it is a similar issue on Xbox and PS4, I can't imagine them not patching this sort of thing later. At least I would hope it would be. So, yeah, I'm going to keep this eye on it for my own personal use, too. I think this could be a really good one.
Cool. All right, well, that is it for you. Were you going to head out? I know you're not feeling the best.
I'm heading out, guys. I tested positive for COVID, but today I have tested negative for the first time, so I'm getting
Yay.
Over it.
Well,
that's good to hear.
But I'm going to bed, for real.
So. Yeah, I hope you feel better soon.
Thank you. Each day is a lot better. Like, today I feel super normal, so I think it's all going to be great from here. Thank you for your patience with me tonight.
Getting a negative test result is no excuse to get less sleep.
I know. I
always get a full night's sleep.
I know, you're right. We both need to get that on lockdown tonight, starting tonight.
God, you ain't lying. Just way to put me on the spot.
We're going to get through this, man. All right, good night, everybody.
Have See a good buddy. One.
Night.
Later.
Moving on, next game is The Legend of Bumbo, developed by Edmund McMillan and James Interactive, published by Nicholas, released June 29th on Xbox Series X and S, PS5, and Switch for $19.99. The Legend of Bumbo is a puzzle-based deck-building roguelike where players collect hordes of items that can be modified, upgraded, and comboed with others in many interesting ways. Plays one of many Bumbo, each with its own unique abilities as they smash, bash, and splash their way through a variety of cardboard monstrosities, giant bosses, and dark personal urges. Oh, and it's also the prequel to The Binding of Isaac. So, Pernell, tell us about your time with The Legend of Bumbo.
If you've played The Bun, at whom I can, you might not have played The Legend of The Binding of Isaac, so I shouldn't act like that. The idea behind this game is very strange. You play as Bumbo, individual who enjoys his life living in a cardboard box with garbage and a single coin that he cherishes like as precious that it is. Until one day, someone takes his coin and jumps down a sewer with the coin. And Bumbo ain't having none of that, so Bumbo decides to go after him to get his coin back. But what ends up happening is he ends up going on an interesting adventure. It's not just a simple task of finding weird, creepy guy who stole single homeless man's single product of identity. No, he has to go through a massive dungeon to find him. And the dungeon crawl, unlike The Binding of Isaac, is a puzzle game. So the part that I reference as being, like, if you're familiar with The Binding of Isaac, is the things you work with in this game are generally pretty gross. The objects you're trying to match in this, basically match for a puzzle game, are bones, poop, boogers, teeth, and piss. Those are the objects, and that's what you're trying to match. Now, it's interesting because at the beginning of every round, enemies will show up on the top of the screen. And sometimes a lot of them, sometimes a few, and they have their own levels of hit points that they need to have knocked off of them in order to kill them. Now, at the bottom of the screen is your puzzle board. And all the objects that I just mentioned will appear on this board. Now, as you grab, if you push the A button, you will grab a point on the board where the cursor is highlighted, and you can slide the column or the row until you're satisfied with where it ends up. And if you have like a certain number of moves per round, which you can then engage this. And if you can break four or more objects, you'll get an effect. For example, if you can match four bones, you'll get a bone throw attack, where you can throw a bone at an enemy and it'll do damage. If you match four teeth, you'll throw a tooth, which is somewhat stronger than bones. I don't know much of a difference beyond that in the general sense, but I'll get to the real difference later. If you match piss, you get an extra move. If you match poop, you get a wall barrier that can go up to prevent, you know, damage from coming at you on an incoming attack. And boogers, you are able to kind of gum up an enemy for one round, regardless of whether or not they're planning to attack you or not. So you need to be smart about when you use boogers. Now, if you are able to match 7 of them in a row, which is a little bit more challenging because, again, they usually break if you match 4 together. So you got to pretty much get 3 on one side, 3 on another, and then the last one in the middle to get a 7. But if you can pull that off, you'll get a super bonus related to the type of attack you use. I'm not going to go through all of them, but to give you an example, if you match 7 piss, you'll get 4 moves. And if you match 7 poop, you'll get a barrier on every column on the opposing side with the max level of 3, which is pretty freaking good if you're in a pinch, but good luck pulling that off. Now, in addition to what I just said, the normal attacks that come from those things, you also have access to a variety of different spells. I'll talk about that shortly too. Each Bumbo starts with a few different spell attacks that can have different effects. And the effects can vary. For example, one of my favorite ones is pretty simple. You use it and you stab one tile on the board to make it break, which makes the column that is on fall down. So you can kind of set up some nice little combos that way. It's like very specific pinpoint, you know, finessing of your combos. And you can use those spells based on a certain, basically what combination of things you break. For example, the thing that I just mentioned before, the remove a single tile costs 2 teeth. So you destroy 2 teeth on the puzzle board, and you can use that action one time. Unlike the actual sliding tile moves, though, spells don't cost turns. So, again, when you find yourself in a pinch, you might be thankful that you have some mana use to actually cast a spell that might be able to save your ass at the last second. Now, enemies don't attack every round, but when they do plan to attack, the game will give you an indication by the enemies having like an exclamation icon above their head, and if you don't stop them by some manner, as using boogers or poop, or just killing them instead, you will receive damage equivalent to whatever damage level that enemy can do. So, you'll be fighting doing that a lot. You'll find yourself constantly stressed out because, oh my god, most
this
of the
is
Bumbos
a stressful
pretty much
game. This really is.
It's a very stressful game. I like it, but it is very stressful. Even from the very first level, you can easily find yourself in a pinch where, like, how am I going to die on the second map? This is ridiculous. But it has happened to me before. But it's still a lot of fun. It's just, you got to come in knowing that you might get your ass handed to you. Now, for every time you beat a room, you'll get a bag drop where some money will appear. I'm not honestly sure what determines how much money you get. If it's based on how fast you beat a room or if it's just predetermined, I have no idea. But you get money when you beat rooms, and then you move on to the next room. Though sometimes in between rooms, you might come across an event space, being like a merchant who will offer you a choice of 2 things at no cost to you. Usually like a new spell or a trinket item that you can use for like a buff, or a special multi-use item, stuff like that, which will make it easier for you to make your progress through the dungeons. At the end of each floor, or each area, rather, you'll come across a boss. Just like in Binding of Isaac, each area has a series of bosses you can encounter at any given time. So each floor doesn't just have one boss. And they generally carry their own little gimmicks. Like, for example, there was one enemy I remember fighting. It was like a giant poop monster who stomps closer and closer to the front of the screen. And every time you hit him, you send him back, but he then releases 3 monsters that you got to kill, too.
Yeah,
but if you don't kill
him,
he'll stomp. Yes, it's really gross. But this is what this guy does. I don't know what his obsession is with this stuff. Maybe it's just the lore that he's trying to stick with since he already started with Binding of Isaac. But I'm like, man, where do you come up with this shit? But if you can beat the boss before you go into the next area, there's like a sort of casino that you can unlock or you go to where you can spend the money you earn in each room to do a few things. You can either spin a wheel to increase your stats that you get based like your attack, move, luck, and I don't even know what the puzzle piece stat refers to. I never paid much attention to it. You can increase one of those stats. You can also get like certain buffs. Like you can like say change the element that a spell uses. So you might, if you got a spell that uses piss and you don't like using piss for that spell, you want to use piss for another one, you can spend this cost, use this item to change the piss requirement to teeth or something like that. Of course, it's randomized, so you don't know what it's going to become, so good luck. And then after that, you are done. Sort of. Because early on in the game, if you haven't unlocked any other Bumbo, the first time you beat the first area, you'll unlock a new Bumbo, and your game ends immediately. You go back to the starting screen, you can start another run, but this time you can choose between either your starting Bumbo or the one you just unlocked, and he comes with his own spells, like I mentioned earlier in the review. Now, if you beat the first four, you're going to the next dungeon. But every time you have a scenario where you unlock a character, it does end your game. But it only happens the one time. And beyond that, you just kind of keep pressing forward to get to the end of the game. And there's a variety of different Bumbos you can unlock. Sometimes it's based off of beating a certain area with a specific Bumbo. Sometimes it's beating like one of them up, which I don't think I'll ever get, is beating the first area without taking a single hit. Good fucking luck. But yeah, I haven't pulled that off yet. But yeah, there's a variety of different ones in the game. I like the fact that they all kind of come with their own play styles and starting spells and starting stats. So the game is hard. I'm not going to mince words. The game is disgusting. I'm also not going to mince words. But it's also very fun. I've been enjoying my play with this game, despite the fact that every round I kind of spend way more time than I'm probably supposed to making decisions on what moves to make. I like this game. It's a good time. The only thing I might say might be a complaint, again, this goes back to people who may have played Binding of Isaac, is because due to the nature of the game, you're not going to get the same volume of crazy combinations of items that you would probably get in Binding of Isaac. But then again, Binding of Isaac also had hundreds of freaking items by the time he was done doing development work for it, so it's kind of an unfair comparison to make. But I still figured I should mention it anyway.
It's not that unfair. If you look at the features for the game, there's 100 plus unique items that can be modified and upgraded.
Unique.
80 plus unique trinkets that give Nito passive abilities. And 4 plus playable characters, each with their own unique ability.
So, yeah, that's the thing. Like, it's
that's off the store page, by the way. I didn't make that up.
Unique mania.
Three uniques in a row on the store page. I fucking love it.
But it just goes to show you, nonetheless, even with that variety of things, 80 plus 100, that's just not even a plus because, permutations, but 80, 100, 4, and permutations of all that, that's a lot of combinations, and it still pales to what you can get out of the Binding of Isaac.
Oh, yeah.
But with that said, it doesn't mean that the combinations in this game aren't fun. They're still very much enjoyable, especially if you get the cool synergy where like you might get like a specific spell that produces results that generate benefits to another spell you might have acquired, and then you just kind of start steamrolling along that. I've yet to come across infinite spell loop, but I'm guessing he probably programmed the game to avoid having you come across anything like that anyway, but I'm still hoping.
All those options, you never know.
Oh, yeah. But with that said, I think this game is a genuinely good title, especially if you're already fond of sliding block puzzle games. I like the ones where you kind of have an end goal and it's not just, hey, can you match three lollipops to get to the next candy cane? I like this game. It's a good time. I like the stress that it gives me when I'm trying to make decisions because it's not as simple as like just buying another turn. I'm actually engaged and I want to progress further in the shit dungeon.
Well, then $20. What are your thoughts on the shit dungeon?
I think it's worth buying. It's a solid buy title.
Cool. Works for me. I'm enjoying this one, too. It's hard as fuck, but I'm going to keep at it. I'm going to keep trying. The dude with the eyeballs, where every fucking time I hit the eyeball and they would just be like, resisted and move to the side. Like, fuck you. Just let me hit the boss. Does,
now that you mentioned that, is one thing we should point out to people. I didn't even think about that, but I'm glad you said it. So this game is seriously all about learning by doing. Yeah. So you'll come across enemies. The game does no tutorial to tell you who's resistant to what or who can do what. So they'll just be like, oh, new enemy. I'm going to throw some teeth at it. And the game's like, nope. You're like, what do you mean, nope? You just learned the hard way that he's resistant to teeth. Now you're fucked. So prepare for that kind of thing. But you'll just have to remember as you experience the game, oh, that's the guy that's resistant to teeth.
Yeah, it's a learning experience, but it's fun. Next game is Demon Turf Neon Splash, developed by Fabraz, published by Platonic Friends. Released April 14th on the Switch and PC for $4.99. Whoa, Biebs and her friends were sucked into the neon-splattered world of the painting and need to get the heck out of there. Can you escape these dungeons and surrealist environments using your platforming skills to get back home? Chris, did you?
No. Oh. It is funny, though, that it said, get the heck out of there, because, you know, heck is where you were in the original game. Also, very prescient for Purnell to have mentioned other games being like, collect all the lollipops and stuff. Literally, lollipops are the collectible in this game. So, well played, sir. Okay, just a couple weeks ago, it feels like, I checked out the original Demon Turf, and I basically said that it's a really fun, challenging platformer that reminds me a lot of Mario 64, in, like, maybe not a way that I'm, you know, because Mario 64 is one of my favorite games, so it's, you know, that may be a little lofty of praise, but it's very solid, and, you know, it's 2D characters on 3D planes, you know, different things like that, where you go through different levels and collect and drop your flag and stuff. So this isn't an extension of that. It's basically what they're considering a freestanding DLC. So this is a game that can be played. It is considered an extension of the original game. However, it can be purchased and played completely separate from the original game. So in that sense, it kind of acts as a demo because it's a little bit cheaper. It can also be bought in conjunction with the other game. They're available as a 2-for-1. So, basically, yes, this game, like Mario 64, has everybody getting into a painting and then ending up in a different world. To be specific, there's 10 worlds, and to be even more specific, bordering on pedantic, there are also remix levels, which are available for, I think, 9 of them? Yeah, 9 of them. So there's actually 19 stages. It's just that the remix levels use the same assets and build as the original levels, but are completely different.
I'm looking at the store page. It says there's 10 remix levels, and that's in addition to exploring the 10 finely crafted levels with a plethora of unique challenges and hazards that are constantly introduced to you at a record pace.
There must be like one final level then, because yeah, when I'm looking at the 10 stages, it says switch to remix levels, and when I click that, it pulls up 9 more levels.
Hmm.
So it's 19 from my view, but if they say it's 20, then it must be 20. I guess you have to unlock them by beating all the rest of them.
Maybe.
I did not do that because this is still a hard game. And yeah. So yeah, the basics are that, like I said, it's a 2D character, Biebs, who is running through these large 3D stages, doing challenge platforming, which involves a myriad even of moves that are basically carried over from the last game with a few exceptions. There's a couple of moves that are missing because there's a couple of things that are missing, namely the enemies. Apparently, this game is, they just decided to just take out the enemies because those weren't really doing anything for anybody, and they just make it all about the platforming and, you know, the jumping from place to place, collecting stuff, and just generally having a good time with that. That is not to say there's not going to be challenge in this thing. There is. And I don't know, maybe there are enemies thrown in towards the end or whatever, but yeah, it's funny enough, because the enemies didn't really add too much to the original game. I mean, the idea behind it is that you can't really murder them directly. You had to, like, bump them into spikes and things like that, you know? So I'm kind of glad to have that done away with, because the platforming really is the strength of these games anyway. So the look of the game has changed. It used to be a red-tinted trip through heck. Now it is a bright, in-your-face neon journey where even the protagonist is now bathed in the kind of synth-wave blue and purple lights of a faux 80s kind of experience. And so, yeah, the character looks even slightly different. The stages definitely look different. They're very surreal and, you know, painting-like. The game actually does feature what's called an RGB split, which kind of looks like when you're looking at something where you're supposed to be looking at it with 3D glasses, you know how everything's like kind of split apart into two different colors. It kind of does that, but there's no 3D glasses, so it doesn't do it too much. It's just, it gives it a strange kind of blur and a little bit of thing. Apparently some people like it. It can be turned off in the menu so that you can just deal with good old mom and pop polygons.
You should. Do you have any 3D glasses to see if it does a 3D effect?
It doesn't because they aren't chroma split. And they're not blue and red. It's like, okay. It's just everything is kind of split into like different color gradients.
Well, that sounds awful. So,
yeah, it wasn't that bad. But once I like looked at the, I played like through a couple of levels before I even opened the menu. Cause I was like, last time I got too intimidated by the menu. So I was like, I'm not even going to look at it this time. And so, yeah, I beat a couple of levels and I found that in the visual menu. And I was like, oh, okay. So that's what that is. And turned it off. Also, the cool thing about it is that the buttons on the controller can be entirely remapped, like, to anything you want, pretty much. So, like, that's kind of cool, too. Like, the games both pride themselves on giving you way too many options. And, you know. So, yeah, the other thing about this game's aesthetics is that the soundtrack is, like, a jumbo pixie stick of EDM. It's just... The last game was kind of funky and kind of cool and, like, you know, laid back in some places. It got the energy up sometimes. This game just, like, starts at 11 and goes up from there. I think Joe actually posted the music in the chat earlier even. I really, really enjoy it. I actually like this even better than the last game's music, so that's really cool and well done. But yeah, it's pretty much, like I said, it's all about like learning and mastering the moves. You know, you have like a triple jump, you have a spinning move that you can combine with certain jumps in order to get like super jumps. Like there's all kinds of like intricate like moves that you can learn. But the game doesn't require you to like master these things really. It's if you can get there, you can get there. They don't like, you know, it's basically to where, you know, it's kind of like they give you the tools, but they don't really require mastery over the tools to get through most of it. However, you probably will want to, because in order to get trophies, you're going to have to beat these stages in a certain amount of time. So there's gold trophies for speedrunning, essentially. There's also a universal timer you can use. There's even a feature in the options where you can start the entire game over every death for speedrunners who want to try and get through this whole thing. Obviously, all those can be toggled off, and that's how
thankfully,
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing is that you collect, like I said, you know, lollipops. There's, I think, 80 per stage, maybe more, depending on what, but I'm seeing 80 on all the stages I can see them on. There's also those vinyl records, and I believe that those unlock the remix levels. They're tucked away, usually, right within sight, but, you know, they're a little hard to get to, but therein lies the challenge. So there's a lot of stuff going on here, but ultimately, yeah, it's the same, it's the same game as the other one, but with a lot more sugar and a lot less enemies.
And a lot cheaper, because it's only $5.
Yeah. So, for $5, I would say, definitely, yeah, it's a fuck it, why not on that basis, just for the amount of content that you get and also the amount of care that went into this game, which is obviously a lot. However, I'm going to go ahead and suggest that you purchase the double pack if you haven't purchased a Demon's Turf already. The games are cute. I like them. And like I said, it's spiritually a lot like, you know, a Mario 64 or something like that. It kind of has that. It has this great sense of what makes 3D platformers great when they are, which is rarely.
Well, I am going to go against your recommendation and suggest that people buy them individually because they're on sale and they're cheaper to buy them separately than to buy the bundle right now. So.
Well, I didn't know that because this is Nintendo, and whenever I try to look at the price, it just says purchased.
Yep.
Which I wish that Nintendo wouldn't do, and then also let us buy games for other people, Nintendo, please. We'll give you more money.
The sale prices, and I do agree with Chris, I want to buy games for other people.
Demon Turf is $20 instead of $25, and Neon Splash is $4.50 instead of $5.
Okay. Okay.
And if you're interested, there is a physical version available. I know GameStop carries it. I did see it getting higher prices on used retail sites. So if you're interested, check your local store, see if they have it. And it's still, I think, only $25 physical. So.
Oh, wow. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. I remember that being like the sticking point for the price is that it was a little high for the original. But yeah, $25 for two games like this, that's even better.
There you go. All right, next up is Hourglass, developed and published by Secret Item Games, released June 30th on Xbox One, Series X and S, Switch, PS4, and PS5 for $24.99. In Hourglass, you can create a time clone of yourself to solve challenging puzzles. You'll play as Awa, a young adventurer who is traveling to Egypt to find her missing father, an archaeologist who never returned from his latest expedition. Pernell, tell us about your time spent with Hourglass.
So, Hourglass is a fine example of a game that takes a single gimmick and runs the living shit out of it. But at the same time, it's a fun gimmick, so it doesn't matter. It's just like saying, hey, by the time you're done with this, you're going to feel like you got your money's worth or you got your time out of the gimmick. It doesn't get underplayed. The idea being that, yes, you're exploring a series of ruins, and your character's only ability is the ability to walk through special gates. And once she does so, it'll start like a clock of sorts, where every action you take is recorded that is then played back after the timer runs out. It only plays it back the one time, though, so you can't just like watch it and then time it and execute your thing just right. But it'll run the one time, and while it's doing so, you still can manipulate your own character to do something in tandem with it. So, for example, you might come across a switch that powers a door. You step on the switch and the door opens. But when you get off the switch, the door closes. So how do you get into the door if you can't stand on the switch to do it? Well, you record yourself standing on the switch, and then once your temporal form is recorded, you take your physical form and run through the door. Easy peasy, beautiful cover girl. That's how that works. But then after that, the game decides, okay, we'll take that concept and we'll do a little bit more with it. Now you need to get across this ravine. However, the ravine has a bridge that only exists when you're standing on the switch. But also, you need to actually carry something across, because once you're not standing on the switch anymore, you can't walk across. It'll close up, and you need to actually be on the other side to do something. So this is me being really ridiculous in the description, but you could say, make the bridge come out holding a square by putting a square on a ledge. Then grab another block and carry it across the bridge. Record yourself doing it, mind you. Then, using your physical form, pick up the first block you put down, then jump onto the larger brick so that the bridge goes away, but your recorded image is still running across where the bridge used to be. So now, suddenly, you are a floating block because a manifestation of you is carrying the block. It does crazy stuff like this throughout the time of the game. It's interesting how much mileage they get out of a simple mechanic, but they do a good job with it. The environments are very nice to look at. The puzzles are relaxing, but also occasionally kind of like, what the hell do they want me to do here? Especially if the environments that you need to work in get bigger and bigger. Because now it's not a simple like playground that you can see everything within like one vantage point. Now you have to move around and get a lay of the land and go, okay, that activates that, but I need to get to that, but I can't get to that because this thing's over there. How do I get to that thing? And now you have to put together a series of steps to solve one puzzle. So as a result, that's when the game starts to get a little bit more complicated. But it's fun throughout the time. The only thing I really wish the game had to offer was like, you know, the typical, it's funny, we just joked about it on two different reviews, but I wish I had more of a collectible element to it. I wish I was finding things unrelated to the plot so I could be like, here's an excuse to explore beyond the confines of the puzzles the game has set up. But unfortunately, from what I could tell at least, it's very much straight to the point. Solve those damn puzzles and move forward into the game. And with that said, though, not every puzzle revolves solely around, you know, the time mechanic or the temporal mechanic. There are scenarios where you have to like, do the difficult stuff like switch puzzles or remembering icons or data maps and then taking them to another place and manipulate a series of objects using what you remember from a previous thing. That stuff's all here, too. It's just the time mechanic is the showstopper. That's the pride and joy. I think the game is solid. I don't want to go based off of the price, though, because that's up to anybody else who's playing it, per se. But I think the game is fun, and I definitely think it's worth the purchase. If you don't think $24.99 is worth it, again, I say this all the time, get it on sale. But at the crux of it, as far as a game is concerned, I think it's a fun game and is worthy of your time. just don't come in here expecting to be dodging monsters or finding hidden secret, you know, tomb lollipops or anything. You ain't going to find them in this place. Just adventure.
Sounds good. All right, we got one final game to talk about tonight. That is called Super Ember Kaboom, developed and published by Josh Koenig. Released June 15th on Steam for $6.99. Super Ember Kaboom is a fast-paced, cute and colorful action game. It has tight controls and simple to learn, difficult to master gameplay that makes each level a joy to run through. Chris, tell us about your time with Super Ember Kaboom.
Super Ember Kaboom. Okay. Let me look this up and see what kind of game this is. No, I was actually... No, I'm just kidding. I can't look at the game while I'm talking, which is a habit of mine. I like to look at the game while I'm talking so that I can remind myself of things as I go, because unlike professionals like Brooke, I don't actually write anything down. And you'll get to see me not succeed with that in real time.
Hey, I never write anything down either, and I think the quality shows.
I think Brooke is the only one of us that does write stuff down.
Yeah, and that's why her reviews are so good.
Anyways,
so Super Ember Kaboom. So this is, I mentioned that the last game was like, was a little bit like Mario 64. This one actually kind of kicks it a little closer to Super Mario World, because it is a 2D level-based platformer that basically, it operates on a grid of like different interconnected worlds that, you know, have like the little, you know, the square, and then you move along the line to the next square and, you know, things like that. So it'll remind you a lot of like a thing like Super Mario World or any one of those other kind of games, Super Mario 3 as well. And in these stages, they're fairly short stages for the most part. You are playing as this fox girl thing, whatever, sprite. And you run through and you can bash enemies with your tail, or, you know, you can collect different spirits that are trapped in bubbles, because an evil wizard decided he was going to trap some spirits in some bubbles. That's the plot of the game. And when you collect them, you get a certain power. So, like, if you collect a fire spirit, then you can shoot fireballs, and they're all, like, limited ammo. Basically, as soon as you use them all, then you just go back to your standard move set. But yeah, you get like fireballs, you get ice that trails along the ground towards the enemies, you get light, which I don't know, it just kicks ass. It's like whatever you're pointing at, basically they get blowed up. And then, you know, there's a dash move as well that's to do with the wind and things like that. So basically, yeah, these are scattered all over the place. You basically run at a fairly high speed, picking those up. You also pick up fruits. I don't know what the increment is, but every so often enough fruits gets you an extra life. Extra lives are extremely abundant if you're pretty good at the game, because like by the time I ended up, you know, leaving the game, I had like over 50 lives, and every time I would like die in a stage, I'd go back in and collect enough fruit to have 5 more lives. So it's like I kept getting lives from starting stages over and stuff. But dying won't happen too much, at least not for the first several worlds. The game is skews on the easy side, that's for sure. You know, it gets eventually, like, it gets a little harder, but honestly, I feel like it only gets to kind of normal difficulty, but you're so used to breezing through stages at that point that you just kind of, like, you know. But they have a mechanic in place to kind of help mitigate this, and that is the lives, or the basically the hit system. You can choose how many hits it takes to kill you, 4 being the normal default, but you can set it down to 1. You could even increase it to 5, which is considered the casual difficulty. I'm not sure if these also change enemy behaviors or anything. Enemies tend to move in patterns, and, you know, some of them kind of just run at you, some of them, you know, fly at you, and, you know, some of them just occupy spots that you're trying to jump to, and that is the ultimate crime in a platformer. Either way, playing it on the normal difficulty, I just played it on default, and yeah, I found it very, very, very breezy. So that will be a selling point for some people, because you know that a lot of indie platformers pride themselves on being tough as nails, as if we're, you know, not going to just beat them and move on. But yeah, so that's pretty cool. I like the graphics in it. The boss fights are pretty interesting. Generally, the boss like attacks you in a pattern and stuff, but periodically a spirit bubble will appear, and so you get to use like different moves against these bosses, basically kind of like on a timer, which is kind of cool. Speaking of timers, some of the stages are set up a little bit differently. Rather than just jump towards the... Oh, by the way, there's flags and midpoints. Speaking of Super Mario World, grab a flag for the halfway point and then another one to the end of level. Some of them are on a timer. Some of them will actually feature a like shadow version of the character that will basically chase you throughout the stage and just do damage and generally act a nuisance. You cannot attack or defeat the thing. You just have to kind of basically try to get through the level, either outrunning it or dodging its sporadic movements. So yeah, there's a good variety of stuff in here. In every level, there's four collectibles. They look like, I guess, jewels or something. And those are not only for getting a perfect score in the stage, because they're basically the only collectible that matters in the stage, but... if you gather enough of them, then you can unlock special stages and therefore special areas. I haven't gotten to the really high cost ones, but I saw that there was one that took like 172 of these things in order to access. So there's clearly, you know, you're meant to play this game for quite a while. So that's pretty cool. And yeah, apart from that, the only real complaint I have, and it's like, it's not a complaint, it's, let's call it like a question mark above my head. The music in the game is quite good, but doesn't feel super appropriate for the kind of game it is. All of it basically sounds like really high energy anime intros, like straight up J-pop. And I think it's just because the music is just licensed from elsewhere, because in the credits I did see one person credited, but then another was just like a company that was credited, so I don't know what's going on with that. But yeah, I was kind of like digging the music at first, and then it kind of just switches up between stages. So you're like, if you're in this one world, it'll basically alternate between two songs. You get like three worlds in, and it's like it's alternating between two other different songs, and they all just sound like they're just the opening to like a magical girl anime or something like that. It's good music. It was just confusing to me.
Yeah.
That's
well,
fine.
$6.99. What do you think of the game?
Yeah, this one's a worthwhile pickup. It's definitely made with a lot of care. It's breezy. I just kept finishing levels and kept going on and on and on. I thought I'd be like, yeah, I'll clear one world and then form my opinion that way. And then I cleared five of them. So
nice.
That's yeah. And yeah, it just keeps going like that. So I like it. I'd say it's definitely worth a shot for you.
Well, it looks cute enough. So we'll see. Maybe it'll come to consoles in the future.
Yeah, heck yeah.
My fingers will be crossed for that. But that is it for this show. We made it through another one. Thanks to y'all for being here. Chris, should I just play some of that neon splash music that you linked before?
Yeah, do it.
Okay, so we'll play that.
Flashing!
I imagine the permission is implicit since we're reviewing the game.
I would hope so. I mean, if I had to start asking for permission for all the songs we used, Grant Henry would be really, really busy right now.
Yeah.
For all the times
I use his music. Just don't play Square Enix and you'll be fine.
Or Nintendo. Covers. I don't play official.
Covers are fine. I'm talking about official track. They'll come after your ass.
Yeah, I don't play official shit.
I'm going to play some more of this Wrecking game.
Cool. All right. Anyone have any final words to end the show?
I guess Chris had it. He's going to wreck it.